Hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I trust you've had an interesting and stimulating and intellectually stimulating week. I've certainly missed you, and I've missed all of the gang. And why did you say there's three people watching when I can see more than that in the live stream? But anyway, in the thing at the side. All right, cheers, everybody. So cheers, cheers, Nick. Cheers, Lipton. Cheers, Big Ange for PM. I don't disagree. I think that it would be hilarious. It would be our equivalent of Donald Trump. Yes, cheers, Paul.
Yakida.
Yep, Capis, Saludo, Proust, Prost, Toby Sexy, Skoll, Slanger, and Slangervar.
Scrubunan.
Yeah, Scrubunan and Yakida, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, on a public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which discuss stuff going on in the news from a sort of academic perspective, based science, and all kinds of interesting malarkey. So, cheers, everybody. Protect the British pub. Indeed, Bo said, teacher. Well, this became a kind of online pub during COVID when nobody could go to the pub. We need to make Ed punctual again. We're waiting for Lipton, Mr. John Stuart Cairns, YouTube. We're waiting for Lipton and then having a bit of a chat. But Lipton's here now. Now, we have a very special guest for you today, and that is Mr. Nick Buckley, MBE. And he is standing as the Advance UK candidate. And there is no Rupert Party candidate. There's just Reform, which is this guy, Matt Goodwin, who has sticking out ears. I didn't get around today, trusting chap is sticking out ears. And then there is Nick, and then there's the usual people, and there's a Green and whatever. So he's standing on Thursday, and he's so confident he's going to win. He said, I'm not even going to bother going out campaigning on Monday night. I'm just going to come on the Jolly Heretic. Don't need I've got it in the bag. So hello, Nick.
Hello, and hello, everybody else. And hello to everybody at home watching.
So, well, let's start. I tell you what, let's start with, I don't know if we start with the by-election or start with the arrest of, I mean, Peter Mandelson has just been arrested, chaps. Mm. And I find this... It's the symbol of New Labour. It is New Labour. It's the people that have got us into the state that we're in. It's the people that have got us into the state where there's the possibility of Big Ange becoming PM. I mean, it's the mastermind behind everything over the last 30 years, and he's been arrested. What are your thoughts? What were your immediate thoughts on this, Nick?
First of all, I've met Peter Mandelson. I used to work at Manchester Airport. And I was at the London flight, and the dispatcher said, Nick, we're missing someone called Peter Mandelson. I went, I know who he is. He's in the business lounge. So this would be at the year 2000, it would have been. So I had to go into the business lounge up to him. He was on his phone. I said, Mr. Mandelson, if you don't come with me now, the best I can do is book you on the next London flight, because that flight's leaving in 30 seconds. He looked at me and was just about to say, do you know who I am? When I walked out the business lounge and he grabbed his bag and his coat and he ran after me. I got him on the plane, door shut, he went off.
Well, hang on, why were you sent to do that? Had there been all kinds of calls coming out saying, could Mr. Mandelson please come to the gate, whatever, and he'd just been sitting there?
Yeah. And because he was a business passenger, we would have known he was in the business lounge. So therefore, there would have been calls in the business lounge. Mr. Mandelson, you're going to miss your flight. Mr. Mandelson, last call. But he was on his phone, didn't care.
So what you're saying is basically he thought he was so important that they'll hold the flight till he can be bothered to it.
Yeah, and don't forget that New Labour were in government at that time, so he really thought he was important.
Yeah, year 2000. This was after he'd been sacked, though, isn't it? So I think he was sacked in 90... Was he sacked first in 98?
That doesn't really narrow it down for us.
Yeah.
He was sacked about five times.
Yeah.
Right, so arrogant sod and not very socialist because he was flying business class in the business lounge. So what was your job at the airport, Nick?
I had several jobs at that point then. I think I was dispatching flights or I was... I don't know, but they mentioned his name and because I was into politics, I went, I know who he is and I've just seen him in the business lounge. So that's why I went to get him.
Okay, and he wasn't particularly polite to you?
He didn't say a word to me. He was dismissive. He was about to say, I'm on a phone call, but I just said, I was going back to the flight to say, close the door and be on your way because of heavy penalties for late flights. So I'd already warned him. I was going back to send the flight off, but I could see behind me, he was running after me. So we got him on the flight, customer service. We got him on the flight.
Yeah, it's not running on my YouTube. This is on my Twitter. This live stream that we're doing now is not. It's not running. It's not there. I'm not seeing it. So there's some kind of there's some kind of weird problem. This is the second week that's done this. So I shall speak to the cleaning lady. Yes, it is. It is. Have you met Peter Mandelson, Paul?
I can't say I have. No. I never had the opportunity for him to almost be rude to me, which he almost certainly would have been.
No, he probably would have been, yes. But he's an obsequious, oliginous kind of a guy.
How did you pronounce that, Ed?
I like to pronounce it, and I know how to pronounce it. I like to pronounce it oliginous. I just think it's spelled. I just think that's reasonable. Lipton, back me up on this.
He's an oily guy. I know the word is pronounced, no.
It's probably pronounced with a chip.
Thanks for that, Lipton.
Thank you, Lipton, for sitting on the fence in a fairly major way. Sitting on the fence in the kind of way that an oliginous person would do. No, indeed. But do you think it might be some kind of things might be coming apart if the architect of New Labour has been arrested?
Absolutely. Andrew has been arrested. That's probably led to this. Everybody ends up getting their comeuppance, and it looks like New Labour and some of the people who have been shady over the last couple of decades always gets to a stage where they can't keep the line anymore, and things happen, and it looks like it's happening now.
Indeed it is. I don't understand why it's taken so long, though. I mean, we know there are these awful, appalling people, and yet they've managed to get away with it until they're in their 70s. Having wrecked the country and having done so much damage.
That's because it takes a new bunch of people to come through the system who don't have any allegiances to the old paymasters. So it takes those new people to not owe him any favours to then go after him to make their career.
Yes. And so why did you, though? I mean, one of the things we discussed last week, we had a chap on called Mark Houghton, who is a supporter of the Rupert Party. So don't you think that you're rather, we have Reform, we have Advance UK, and we have whatever this other thing's called. What's it called? Yeah. It's got out of my head. What's it called?
Restore Britain.
Restore Britain, that's the fellow. Right. And Restore Britain is, as far as I can work out, significantly to the right of Reform. They're talking about ethno-nationalism, which Farage has just condemned in a speech recently and said you're like the BNP if you think that, which I think is unwise. But Advance UK is kind of between the two, and indeed the leader is half, who I've interviewed on the Jolly Heritage, is half Pakistani, you know, ethnically. Isn't this just splitting the vote?
I can see it looking like that. First of all, Reform UK are not on the right; they're centrists. They're the new Tory party. So I wouldn't class them on the right at all. Advance UK is on the right and Restore Britain are on the right. Restore Britain, no one saw that coming. No one saw that coming as a political party. It caught everyone off guard. Advance UK and Restore Britain over the next few months or the rest of this year have to work something out. They have to work out how they're going to work together. I've no idea how it's going to pan out. I've paid it no attention at the moment. I've been too busy running my campaign, but you're right. Those two parties will split the right-wing vote, and we need to avoid that at all costs. But again, I don't class Reform on the right. People think they are until you hear their policies, until you realise what the leaders are saying, and then you go, it's just the Tories. It's just more Tory promises.
Well, yeah, but surely it's better that they get elected on Thursday in this by-election than Labour.
Makes absolutely no difference on a national scale, who gets elected. So if Reform win, they have 9 MPs instead of 8. They still can't do anything nationally. The Greens win, they have 5 MPs instead of 4. Can't do anything. This by-election really is about the local people. It's about them getting the best local MP who's going to improve their street, their life, their neighbourhood. At a general election, you might then want to consider the national politics about who's going to form the government. But this by-election, the people are being used as a political football.
Right.
I have a question for Nick.
Pardon?
I have a question for Nick. Yep. Nick, what's your position on welfare? I wasn't born in the UK, but I think that welfare should be scrapped for immigrants, even if they're legal. Only third-generation immigrants should get welfare. First-generation immigrants get no welfare other than the NHS, and I'm saying so because people who migrate here, many of them, especially students, they paid to use the NHS. But other than the NHS, immigrants should get no welfare whatsoever.
I agree with that. Anybody who wasn't born in this country moves here shouldn't be accessing benefits. If we then use that on the second generation, third generation, I don't know. I'd have to give that some thought. But our welfare system is basically killing the country. It's turned the bravest, most aspirational people in the world. It's turned us into beggars, and it only took 70 years. We're just beggars now off the state. Every time we have a problem, the first thing we say is, what's the government going to do about this? It's like, nothing. What are you going to do about your problem? Why do we expect the government to feed our kids at school? Why do we expect the government to interfere in every aspect of our life? So benefits...
They expect the government now, Nick. They send kids to infant school, age four, incontinent.
Yep.
And expect the teachers to change the nappies of their children.
Yep.
Which was unthinkable. When I was started at infant school, I mean, it was different for Paul. He never was dry.
I was potty trained by the age of eight.
He was potty trained by the time he started at Edinburgh University. but only just. I mean, there were moments of lapse and shame. But basically,
he wouldn't notice it in Scotland, Ed. Trust me.
Exactly. They didn't notice it in the part of Edinburgh he lived in. He lived down by the World's End pub, filthy area. murder there in 1979. I do find that amazing, that shift, that this fundamental idea that, well, of course, it's your duty for the good of you, the good of your household, the good of society, whatever, to make sure that your children are potty trained by a reasonable age. Like, it's just self-respect for the children, if nothing else.
Could I just jump in here, because while it's fresh in my mind, what frustrates the hell out of me are things like the NHS, whereby... Yes, it's incredibly complicated, blah, 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 but there are certain things you could do. So, for example, A&E is now used as a social club by some members of the lumpen proletariat, and it would be quite easy for doctor's appointments and A&E to triage much more vehemently to stop time wasters. Anyone who goes to A&E now is facing an eight-hour, wait or worse in a trolley for days on end just because people abuse the system. And it doesn't strike me in the last 10, 15 years anything's been done to address what's a blatantly obvious problem.
When I was in England a year ago or so, my dad was genuinely ill to the extent that he fell down the stairs and couldn't get up. And even then, me and my mum hesitated to ring the ambulance. Even then, we were like, well, surely we can, between us, sort of pick him up and drag him up the stairs and put him in bed, right? And my wife said, no, surely this is time. It's time to ring 999 or whatever. Is it 111? What's the thing that you ring for non-emergency situations like that? And I said, surely no, we can get him up the stairs, can't we? And we couldn't. And it was getting both painful and hilarious. And so we to be fair, they were there quite quickly. This three people, bloke and two girls, they got him up, put him in an ambulance, took him to the hospital. I waited about an hour and got bored and went home. Apparently, he was seen within 2 hours. This is Kingston Hospital, but there was this one woman there, and she'd come in basically because she had a bit of a cough, and was a bit having heart trouble breathing. And this doctor, this posh doctor, young guy, just went, do you smoke? Yeah, I do, love, yeah. Yeah, how much do you smoke? Oh, well, I'm trying to get out. She's like 50 a day, you know. And he says, well, if you stop smoking, then this wouldn't happen to you. Yeah, but it ain't that easy, love. They should just say, shut up, stop smoking, and don't come in here again until you've given up what must be a very expensive habit.
But the simple point, Ed, is there are ways of addressing triage issues that have never been grasped. The other thing is, for about at least 20 years, politicians of nearly every stripe have admitted there's a problem with the social care system in the UK, which means bed blockers create havoc in the NHS. How can you know about a systemic problem for two decades and fail to solve it? That is the state failing at the most basic level. But yeah, it goes to Nick's point about the way in which everything is done for you. The NHS is a ridiculously oversized, over-insulated, over-protected. And then you can't say that because then immediately, oh, but some people do some wonderful work. Well, the NHS in my past saved my life, but also almost killed me. So I'm judging, I'm about even at the moment.
How did they save your life, Paul?
I had very serious health problems when I was 18, and if I lived in America, my whole family would have been bankrupted. So the NHS came good, but then at another date related to that, years later, I was misdiagnosed ridiculously until I basically managed to get referred to a consultant. And I went back. It was quite funny. I made an appointment with the GP to point out what a terrible misdiagnosis it was, just to make sure I'd ruined her Monday morning. And if more people did that, I think it would help as well.
I don't know if the NHS saved my life, but probably they did, yeah, if you're born 3 months prematurely. But
then you've got this guilt trip. If they might have saved your life, they might have saved my life, but that's what a health service is supposed to do.
Exactly.
And I think the British have this bizarre Stockholm syndrome, even when the NHS has got now worse health outcomes than probably Senegal. We've got to be inordinately grateful, despite the fact we pay through the nose.
Exactly. I'm not grateful. I'm not grateful to the NHS. I don't clap for the NHS. They're doing their job, for which they're handsomely paid. So, and they're doing it badly. And the idea that you'd have to wait, I mean, the last time I ever used the NHS was about 2002. And it was a 3-hour wait, which I thought was abominable. And apparently now that's nothing. Three hours is nothing, chaps. 3 hours is the length of an entire WrestleMania.
But Nick, can I ask you, why do you think, given that we can all agree these are, you know, serious problems, my point about it having existed identifiably for 20 years, how can the political class fail so badly to deal with it?
Easy. I worked in local government for a decade. These are the conversations I was party to. We've got a problem. It needs fixing. Well, we agree with that, but what are we going to do? We're going to do these things. What happens if these things go wrong and we get bad press? Oh, let's not do it, because this system was broken before we turned up. We can never get blamed for a broken system we didn't break, but we can get blamed for trying to fix it. It's best to do nothing.
So that's actually the conversation that they had.
I've sat in rooms dozens of times of those sort of conversations.
And you had this thing recently where they released this guy who was insane into the community, because if they didn't release him, then it might be racist. And then he murdered three people? In Nottingham. So these are the kinds of conversations you have, and people are so pusillanimous and that they just sit there and take this.
They do, because they're never judged on their outcomes. Their budgets are renewed every year. It's not a business where you've got to earn that money. Your budget is renewed every year. You may have some technical indication, you know, performance indicators, but they're not looked at. So basically, you do a job that mainly, especially in local government, probably isn't needed, but it gives politicians a strap line of saying, oh, we've got a department that deals with that. Doesn't solve anything, but we've got a department that deals with that issue. And they're just shields for the politicians. And the politicians don't want to upset the civil servants, because the civil servants also massage and lie for the politicians. So it's this symbiotic relationship where all of us are incompetent, the elected officials and the hired officials. And if one of us fall, we're all going to fall. So let's protect each other.
But this must have got worse, though. Yeah, I mean, So going back to what Paul was saying about how we're meant to be grateful or whatever. Well, let's be grateful in the 1950s when it was quite good. But I'm happy to be grateful then if Call the Midwife is anything like reality, which it isn't. But that's another issue. But why has it got worse?
It's got worse for many reasons. You can hide many of your mistakes for many decades, but the accumulative effects of that makes things worse and worse and worse. And then 15 years ago, we started introducing DEI hires. We now hire more foreign doctors, more foreign nurses. I wrote articles on this. The more likely to make mistakes, the more likely to be disciplined, the more likely to be sacked, the more likely to have false qualifications, fraudulent qualifications. But it's cheaper and easier to hire someone from a different, to steal them basically from a third world country. So all these effects just chip away. And not only the NHS, but all our public services and the country in general are at tipping point. So it only might be one or two more little mistakes, but everything's crumbling around us. We've gotten away with it for 30, 40 years of this pure incompetence. But because our society was built on the shoulders of giants, we had a lot of wiggle room, but all that wiggle room's gone now.
Well, the generation that had really suffered and understood what it was to struggle, they're all dead. Mm. I think things went wrong when everyone got flush toilets. I think when you've got to actually deal with going to the toilet now, it's quite a pleasant thing. You go there, maybe you use your iPhone and play Wordle or something. It's a clean, enjoy that pleasant environment. And it doesn't put you in touch with reality, with the shit and death. Whereas if you had to go down the bottom of the garden in -5 in winter 1930 and go for a shit in the middle of the night, right? You're freezing cold. It stinks. It's putting you in touch with, you're almost like you're a few steps away from a dog that rubs itself in fox shit in order to be a better predator or better, whatever. You're like that, right? You're in touch with the shit.
Have you not had your dinner yet?
So, as you know, Paul, I have dinner quite early.
But I thought, have you missed it this week? Because you're almost tripping with ludicrosity.
It's not ludicrous, right? That is a very, very good point. That's what my granddad used to say. Oh, bloody, you've got to have up the garden. Oh, it's awful. How horrible it was, he'd say. That's what he'd say, because he was Jamaican.
You used to adapt, either buy more corks or eat lots of food that made you constipated.
There is no way that people in the 30s, Paul, deliberately ate food to make them constipated in order to avoid going to the bog in the night.
I'm a quick adapter. That's what I would have done.
No, they would have just been more in touch with the based world. They would have just been more, they'd have understood the struggle. That they're a few meals away from death and shit. Lipton.
Yes, another point to share with Nick, not a question, because he's running to be a member of parliament. He's not a minister. But Nick, I think that it's time for the UK to impose a quota on third world countries based on the percentage of people from those countries on welfare and the percentage of students from those countries who travel to the US, who travel to the UK to study, and then immediately after graduating, they apply for refugee status. There should be a quota on those countries.
I agree. That quota should be zero. I don't want any more immigration. I don't want any immigration. I think we need to close the borders for at least 10 years, if not longer. We need to solve the problems we have now. We need to integrate the people who are staying. We need to deport the people who are not staying. And I think we need to get back to Fortress Europe, Fortress Britain, where if you manage to come here, you're invited here, you get a visa, you need to say to yourself, Jesus, I'm the luckiest man in the world.
Exactly.
But personally,
I'm a student of British economic history. I love Joel Mokyr, the man who won the Nobel Prize, Nicholas Kraft, Deirdre McCloskey. I read all of these people. And I was born in Jamaica. I studied at Glasgow. And the British people have disappointed me. I'm not impressed by the society any at all. What I expected to get is not what I'm getting. I'm experiencing
you
a society.
Come over here, you whine at us.
No, I expected.
Apple thin lips, didn't they?
No. I expected to meet.
I'm very sorry we let you down, Lipton.
I'm being serious. I came here and I met a bunch of young people with no ambition. I went to France, I went to Germany.
Yeah, but we've got no options, Lipton. We're stuck in our own horrible country.
They're 30. If they're 30 or 35 and they feel unwell, they apply for PEEP. You people have disappointed me. You lazy room. You're lazy people.
I completely agree with Lipton. I completely agree. Where I think everything started going wrong was this. It's when we started losing social shame. Societies, individuals, communities would keep each other in check. And once we started losing that, then we allowed anybody to do anything they wanted. And people naturally are lazy. People, not everybody, but, you know, we're designed to take the easiest road because it saves the energy. So we allowed people to do that. And then we had TV shows where we'd bring families on, and my granddad slept with my uncle cousin's 13-year-old bisexual dog. And we started having those programs. And they were a little bit comedic, but what they really did was they told everybody else, it doesn't matter how dysfunctional you are, you're not as bad as that granddad. So therefore, slept people thought that
bisexual dog.
Yes, he's weird.
Yeah. Fucking disgusting. I mean, it's just like...
social shame. We need to bring social shame back.
There was that English professor in Australia that had sex with hundreds of dogs, wasn't there, a few years ago? We can't trust them. But no, social shame, yeah. But that was a kind of social shaming, wasn't it? With the Jeremy Kyle show or whatever, the idea was these people are scum, let's laugh at them. It was kind of like human bear baiting, as a judge said at the time.
It was, but they picked the 0.00001% of people where everybody else looked at those people and went, I'm not as bad as them, therefore I must be normal. And for me, subconsciously, it allowed so much more poor behaviour because I wasn't as bad as that psychopathic lunatic I saw on TV. I must be normal.
That's a good point. When my granddad was 85, he was watching a TV programme about, he was thinking of giving up driving, and he was watching a TV programme about very elderly people. I'm talking in their 100 years old or whatever, who are very bad at driving, still driving. And he said, well, I'm better than them. And so he didn't give up driving. So, and then crashed his car. So you can see, and then had to give up driving. So you can see the problem with getting the absolute worst scum, putting them on telly, and then saying, well, at least you're not as bad as them.
Yeah,
at least you're not as bad as them. Yes, Lipton.
Yes, yeah, so like I take politics and policies seriously. Do you know why? Because I was born in a developing country, and developing countries like to copy rich countries. And if they go to shit, the world will go to shit. And that's what you're experiencing now. Another issue that I have with the UK is the quality of its training program, the apprenticeship programs. Many of them are low quality. They can't be compared to programs in Germany. And there is a surplus of low quality programs in social care and education. That's an issue that you must speak about on a national level. The English, they pioneered the apprenticeship program. That's why England industrialized before everybody else. And today it has a low quality program. Yet again, another disappointment.
Yes, far too many people at university. Get rid of it.
Yeah,
I was going to say, I had another major problem that I don't think we've addressed is the role played by the media. So if I could just give you two very specific examples, but it goes to how it's very difficult to have a political discussion when basic political concepts are traduced. So, for example, when you talk about the assault gangs and so on, the people in the media and those on the extreme left have this new technique where they suddenly pretend not to understand the concept of pro rata and proportionality within a population. So if you say there is a certain community doing X, they say you can't say that because not all of those people do that. And the point is, you're not saying everyone does, but you're saying proportionately more of them do. And that is just the most basic statistical point. But the media play along with it. And the other thing is this question of citizenship. There's this slippage now where anyone can be called British who has citizenship, which may or may not be correct. But if you're going to talk about whether you're English, Scottish, Irish, whatever, citizenship is not the same as having heritage. It's just a really simple point. If I went to Lagos and got Nigerian citizenship, I honestly don't think people in Lagos would keep referring to me as that white Nigerian guy. It just doesn't make any sense. But I could be a Nigerian citizen. Actually having heritage for historical reasons and having citizenship, as long as the two things are constantly conflated, there's no progress in the discussion.
I bet they wouldn't let you either. I mean, like in India, you have to have Indian ancestry to be an Indian citizen. That's the law. And it was the case in a lot of countries until quite recently. I think it was until very recently in Germany, to be a German citizen, it was in the law that you had to have German ancestry. It seems to me absolute basic thing. It's why I have no intention of becoming a Finnish citizen. I think it's ludicrous, the idea that I'm Finnish. I'm not Finnish. Sorry, Lipton.
Personally, I think we should have a path to being a resident and not a citizen. So if you live or work here for 5 years, you can become a resident and you will never vote in elections. But the citizenship part, that should just be abolished or become really expensive to get.
Yeah, but I'm making a slightly different point. What I'm saying is, even if citizenship comes with a lot of rights, you could then debate about whether those rights should come with citizenship. But the fact that you're a citizen is not the same as other things to do with heritage. And that just needs to be recognised. It's just a simple statement of historical fact.
I don't agree
about shy away from it.
I don't agree about the never being able to vote thing. I don't understand that. The whole point of voting originally was that you are having some of your money forcibly extracted from you, and therefore you have the right to have a say in who are the people that are spending that money and how they're spending that money, right? Taxation, representation. That was the idea. So this idea that, oh, you can vote because you're a citizen.
Yeah, but that's changed now. People are voting and never pay tax hardly in their lives. So that link's been broken.
You should not be allowed to vote if you work for the state, because you are part of the state. So you will inherently corrupt the system and vote for big state. And you should not be allowed to vote if you don't pay tax. It seems to me obvious. You have no financial stake in the society. You shouldn't. It's not your money. It's not your money being spent. So you shouldn't be allowed to vote.
So no representation without taxation.
No, exactly. No representation without taxation. That seems to be completely fair. But it should be, whether you are a British national or a foreigner living in the UK, if they tax you, you should have the right to vote. And you don't work for the state, they should have the right to vote. In fact, that's the point I think about, Nick. A lot of people, I did this video recently on Birmingham, which got quite a lot of traction.
Yeah.
And I went to Sparbrook and Sparkhill and whatever. One of the things you notice, if you compare that going there to, let's say, Sutton Coalfield or a white area, in Sutton Coalfield, it's all like Tesco Metro and chain shops and things like this. Okay, you go to Sparkhill or Sparbrook, it's Pakistani area, there's none of that. It's all independent businesses. It's all people that get up in the morning, right? What am I going to do? How can I make money? It's not decadent. Yes, it's true that I've had a solicitor in Sparbrook that openly advertised that it specialised in VAT fraud, which was interesting. But that's what they do. They get up, make a business, do businesses. Whereas the attitude of English youth seems to be, how can I get a job working for somebody else?
True, but part of that will be clan mentality as well. That I'm starting a business in my area, it'll be supported by my local people because I'm related to half of them. We're all Muslims, we all meet at the mosque. So there's that clan mentality as well, and that keeps out some of the change. But the British youth, I completely agree. We've had 70 years now of living in a semi-socialist country. Every decade, we're more and more socialist. And that drives out aspiration, self-worth, self-respect. And we're always looking for someone else to improve our lives for us. And we're always looking at the state to do it. And if I'm a failure, well, that's fine. I'll just sign on the dole. And the dole's very comfortable to a certain extent. So there isn't consequences anymore for being lazy, for not having a dream. There's no consequences for parents, as in, I've got to make sure my kids get up, get to school, get a job, because I'll have to look after them if they fail in life. No, the state will look after them. We're just putting the wrong incentives.
I think that's a really interesting comment that you made there about having a dream. Now, that's a good and a bad thing, because there's having a dream that's, as it were, a non-decadent dream of a reasonable amount of money, a house, whatever, a reasonable lifestyle. And there's the kind of people that will, you know, go to Bristol University and study for a degree in drama. Or a degree in some other subject where there's no prospects, and where basically they're going to end up unemployed with a completely pointless, useless degree. Those kinds of degrees are useful in a society where 10% of people are educated, have a degree. The fact that you have a degree in anything is a symbol that you're intelligent and hardworking, and so people give you a job. Right, great. That's what it was like when Paul was a lad, and to a lesser extent when I was, because it was only 25% that went to university. Now it's 50%. So it's meaningless to have, if you've got a degree in anthropology or sociology or something, what's the bloody point of that?
Does this mean we can discount Lipton's recent qualifications?
What was it? Black studies, wasn't it?
No, I studied MSc in history where I wrote on Indian entrepreneurship.
But when did you get your qualification, Lipton?
2025.
Yeah.
There's something reasonably useful about history. It doesn't just like a lot of these jobs.
Don't backtrack, Ed, just to simp for Lipton.
Yeah, but what are the jobs in anthropology? It's just being an academic. There's no other. What are the jobs? At least in history, we want history teachers.
What, you can say things are better 100 years ago.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, I'm happy that you made the point about useless degrees. Some degrees are objectively useless. What are you going to do with a degree in feminist studies? Not much. But what I can tell you is that, based on my observation, young people in England, they don't know how to commercialize their degree. So I wouldn't study drama, but being a socially ambitious person, I would repackage my drama degree in such a way that it would sway people to employ me as a communication specialist or as a marketing specialist. When I was in Jamaica, I worked full-time and I did interviews at many corporate companies. Some of them I turned down the offers because I did not want to work at those companies. But my history degrees have been quite useful because I'm good at repackaging a history degree as a degree that can help people in finance. So these students, they go to university to study drama or literature, any subject, and they graduate not knowing how to make their degree commercially valuable. I think that's the problem.
Yes, I agree. I agree. I mean, a degree at Oxford in the 16th century, let's say it was in Latin and Greek, which is probably what it was in, or theology, would do that, right? You'd learn that, and you'd also learn as part of your course things like dancing. and rhetoric and physiognomy and all kinds of malarkey. You know, the Oxford 16th century degree was a kind of every man's education.
But I'd make a separate point as well that I don't personally think there's anything wrong with as many people doing as many degrees as you possibly want in as many ridiculous subjects. The problem then is there's a separate problem. There isn't a society in which, A, you can do what Lipton's just suggested, repackage what you've learned, or just treat what you've learned as an experience and you're a better rounded human being, but then go off and be entrepreneurial. That the grounds to be entrepreneurial have gone. So you get a useless degree, which wouldn't be a problem in an entrepreneurial society, but suddenly the only outlet you expect to be put on a plate for you by a society, as Nick is saying, where everything is provided for you.
Because you're used to it. You're used to it. You're in your parents' generation, where 10% of people went to university, you'd go to university and you'd immediately get a job.
But the two things don't necessarily follow.
I know they don't. And even when my cohort left university in 2002, nobody had a problem getting a job. Nobody. Hmm. Nobody. Piece of piss.
Yeah, but one of the problems, for example, is the new employment legislation. Why would you? I can't see why any small business person now would ever employ anyone, because they have workers' rights from day one. If you said anything vaguely off colour, Ed, you could never employ anyone ever. You'd be in prison. It just wouldn't work. And these are, so how do you create, I totally agree with you, Nick, but how do you create this entrepreneurial culture when everything is interfering to go against it?
I actually have a stable of six bitches. So, it's going okay. And they all call me daddy. But anyway, Nick, sorry.
I was just going to say, we get to that by removing the state. It's a state that's hammering us and putting barriers in front of everybody all the time. Let's look at useless degrees. Those individuals who do useless degrees have been sold a lie. They've been sold a lie by the government and society at large. Go to university, get 50, 80 grand's worth of debt. It'll be great. It'll be worth it. And at 18, 19, what do you really know? So you go down that path because that's what society is telling you to do. Then you come out the other end and you've got a useless degree, loads of debt, and there's nothing you can do about it. And then trying to look at the entrepreneurial spirit in the British, in the English, that used to exist. But decades and decades of socialist governments in this country, and I include the Tories in this because they were socialists, basically, have hammered all that out of us now. It's so hard to set a business up. You know, the risk you put into it, but your employees can sue you. You know, now they've got rights from day one, the amount of tax you pay. And Lipton was saying before about apprenticeships and things like that. If we taxed our businesses less, and took government away from trying to design the apprenticeship programs, businesses would do it themselves if we ended mass migration. Of course, businesses want better people working for them. And businesses used to train their own apprenticeships and do it in-house to the standard they wanted. But then the government interfered, took over, and it all went downhill.
It wasn't just that either. It was professions to a really quite a high level.
Mm.
So when I was in the Wimbledon Conservative Association when I was a lad, this chap, I think he was born about 1914, he was a solicitor by profession. He didn't go to university. You know, even barristers didn't necessarily go to university in those days. I remember him saying, well, there was only Oxford, Cambridge and Durham where you could do law, so, you know, didn't bother. He apprenticed to be a solicitor, and you had to pay for the privilege of working in this chap's office.
Mm.
And you'd do it over a period of time, and within, I think it took about 6 years, and then you were qualified. My grandfather the same. He was a mechanical engineer. He didn't go to university. Mm-hmm. You just apprenticed with a particular company. They trained you. You had to pay them. Pay them for the privilege of being trained by them. And that was how it was done. Architects as well. Accountants. My father's brother was an architect. Never went to university. And then they've taken it over. You all have to go to university now. And all it means is you spend how many years doing your architecture degree? 3 years. And then the training. Mm. Then you do your certificate. And then you do a load of other stuff. Whereas in the old days, the architecture degree or the law degree, you didn't bother with that. You just did the training.
Same with nurses. You didn't need a degree to be a nurse when I was a kid. Then they've put this blockage now. That's why we're short of nurses. That's why nurses are in debt, 80 grand worth of debt before they've even got a job, some of them. Our government keeps putting barriers in front of us to be a prosperous nation.
Yeah. And just get on with it. Why, you know, should there necessarily even be, even the idea that there's a regulatory body, that's another thing that comes in. So let's say like genealogists. Okay, they're not very important. They don't deal with lives. But there's no regulatory body to being a genealogist. Anybody can set themselves up as one.
Mm.
And that used to be the case if you go back to the 17th century with law. You became a lawyer because you had a reputation of knowing about the law. Mm. That was it. There wasn't even necessarily enough. You'd just hang around the courts, do a bit of scribing. And that was how law worked at the low level, at the Inns of Chancery. The level of what then became solicitors. So no, it's insane. We need to roll back the state and just get on with it. Now we're about my learned friend, says Resident Poet. Hello, Resident Poet. How are you doing? Good to see you. Okay, now we're about halfway through. So those of you new, hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We're an online public house. Meets on Mondays at 7 PM UK time, 2 PM New York. We discuss based science, stuff going on in the news, all kinds of malarkey from a variety of perspectives. My perspective, which is kind of evolutionary psychology, Paul's perspective, which is nihilism, and Lipton's perspective, which is a sort of eccentric Jamaican historian. And we have a special guest today, which is Nick Buckley, MBE. And if you're watching this in the Gorton constituency of Manchester, then you should all vote for Nick on Thursday to be your Member of Parliament. I think it would be terrific to wake up on Thursday to discover that Nick had been elected the Member of Parliament for Manchester Gorton. If you're new, would you please subscribe? Subscribe on YouTube, which most of you seem to be watching on for some reason today because Twitter isn't working properly. And subscribe on my Substack, which is jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most based science stuff up on YouTube, in-person interviews, including with Nick, but that wasn't in person, but anyway. Vlogs, blogs, films I make, all kinds of stuff. And where you like what I do, you can subscribe for the cost of a pint of beer a month. And also remember to buy my brilliant new book, The Quaker Question, Exposing the Sect that really rules the world. Next to me, we have Mr. Nick Buckley. Nick Buckley is on Twitter, so follow him on there if you're on the old Twitter. I don't think he has a YouTube channel, you do? Okay, what's that called?
It's all my social media, same, at Nick Buckley MBE.
Okay, yeah. So subscribe to at Nick Buckley MBE. I get the impression he's quite proud of having an MBE. Yeah. And good that he managed to keep it and not get stripped of it, you know, for being cancelled. and then below we have Lipton Matthews. He's also on Twitter. He doesn't use it very much. And please subscribe to his channel, which is Lipton Matthews. And then finally we have Big Ange PM, otherwise known as Dr. Paul Taylor. And his channel is Readers of the Lost Art. So please go over there.
Can I give a plug, Ed? I'm doing a particularly good video in a couple of days on Andrew, formerly known as Prince, through the prism of Picasso's work.
That's an interesting connection you've made there.
It is. Picasso was obsessed with the Minotaur, and I see Andrew, formerly known as Prince, as a Minotaur character.
I wonder how relevant it is that he had a Twilight birth. Because basically, his mum was...
It might have been more significant. He was born in a labyrinth.
Yes, maybe he was born in a labyrinth. That's possible. And then immediately attacked by a Minotaur, and then raised by a Minotaur until quite an advanced age. But we didn't know about that. It was covered up by the Quakers.
I think Camilla could pass as a Minotaur.
What was it with Minotaurs? What was their power?
Well, they were just very strong, but they were very short-sighted as well. So it was a bit of a mixed bag.
In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Yeah.
But there is no king or one-eyed man, and if there was, no one would
But they're very powerful ox-like creatures, but if you're in a very narrow tunnel, that's a bit of a disadvantage.
Right, so you're saying that they're kind of like Diane Abbott, but short-sighted, like Diane Abbott. You're saying he was basically... Ray, he had a twilight birth, which would have pumped him full of morphine, which is going to mess your brain up at a very young age. And then he was the cretins, yes, the Oh, sorry, I forgot to say we have a resident poet.
Sorry,
here.
Ed. Yeah, sorry. Before you do it, I quite like interrupting there, wind you up. But yeah, he was also. You could argue that Andrew, formerly known as Prince, was a bit of a cretin.
Yes. Okay. He's part Greek. You mean, yeah. Resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quim, and he writes the following. Yes. On Thursday, there'll be an election, and already we hear the objection. You're splitting the vote, but let's all take note. Reform will just lead to dejection. Thank you very much, Mr. Quim. And if you like Mr. Quinn's poetry, then you can purchase his book of Jolly Heretic Poetry, which is available on Amazon. And also you can subscribe to his Jolly Heretic Poet YouTube channel. So go over there and do that. So cheers, Mr. Quim, as usual. And thank you very much. Yeah, Nick, you're splitting the vote.
I've been accused. Yeah, the last 4 weeks, that's the number one complaint I've had. I'm splitting the vote. And my answer to that would be this. There is no vote to split because no one's voted yet. And each vote belongs to an individual. And how dare people who don't live in the area start telling other people how they should vote? But worse than that, people are telling the people of Gorton and Denton that we need to remove some of your choice because you're going to make the wrong choice. And for the betterment of my party, we should remove your choice. We should remove some of your rights because you are uneducated, knuckle-dragging idiots. And we don't trust you to make the best decision for you and your family and your community. We had the same accusations that Brexit, that people who voted Brexit didn't know what they were voting for. There's a lot of entitlement and Reform UK supporters that they think those votes belong to them. And they don't belong to anybody. They belong to the individual voter.
There was an opinion piece in the Telegraph today by Tim Stanley. And he argued that Reform are going to lose on Thursday. And he further argued that it's a horrific idea to get involved with Rupert's gang, whose name I have a psychological block on for some reason. Restore Britain, that's the one. He said that these people are extremist These people are, you know, just going to split the Reform vote. These people aren't going to get you anywhere. Get involved with Reform and one day you could be an MP or a SPAD. Get involved with Rupert and he'll just say something silly and it'll damage your reputation by association. It's almost like a threat, really. Almost threatening. So don't do that. Stick with Reform. Don't go for anything that's more based. These people are just silly.
I would disagree with that. Reform to me now are busted flush. They've hit peak Reform. They're going to slowly decline now and probably maybe, you know, get to a steady 22-23% at the next general election. They're not going to be in the 30s any longer now. But let me tell you what I'm hearing on the ground. I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of people now who live in Gorton and Denton. The Greens, Labour and Reform all can win this seat, but the Greens are not as popular as we think. They're not going to do as well as we think. Even if they win, it'll be that tightest margin. Reform are not as popular as you think as well, even in the white working class areas. They still may win, but it's going to be a tiny majority. Labour, we all think Labour are done. Labour's not done. Labour got 50% of the vote in the last election. They're not going to get that. They're going to half that. But people think Labour are done. The amount of people I'm speaking to who are still voting Labour, but then whisper to me, but I don't tell anybody that I'm voting Labour because we're embarrassed now of the brand. So any of those three can win.
And if Why would you vote Labour or Conservative now, yep. considering what they've both done over the last 30 years? And they're shameless, and they don't admit to what they've done, and they just carry on. I don't have anybody, particularly Labour, I mean, Conservative maybe, but how can you, in all good conscience, vote for these insane people? I'd more have more respect for people that voted Green than voted Labour.
I have no idea. If the Greens weren't so mental, you're right. I think more of these Labour voters would switch over. But the Greens, you know, the Greens are now turning into a radical Islamic party. They want to legalise drugs. They want to ban being a landlord. So white working class are looking at what the Greens are advertising, going, I know Labour's crap, but I can't vote for these nutcases. So the Greens are a damaged brand. They're only now a Muslim party in Gorton and Denton. But people get habits, lifetime habits. I'm a Labour voter. I remember Labour history and I want to be part of that. They forget the last 30 years of incompetence.
Nick, could I ask you a question? No. I've long thought, I really wish there was an active, proactive party promoting not voting, but not voting as a civic duty. To get the voter turnout so low that the politicians actually have to stand up and notice. Because I remember when Blair was at his peak, there was a very low turnout. I think it was about 54-55% at one of the general elections he won. And it really bothered him because he thought it ate away at his mandate. And if you could get, you just imagine a scenario where a by-election only 20% voted. At a big high profile, it would at least send some type of message, because this thing about people voting for Labour after they've facilitated the cover-up of the grooming gangs, how any working class person could ever vote for them, it beggars belief.
It does. 2 points there. Whenever I mentioned Labour on the streets now in Gorton and Denton, if I mention Labour or they mention Labour, 50% of the time now, it's followed by them using the phrase Labour, the pedo party, the pedo apologists, the pedo cover-uppers, whatever they say. They connect the word pedo now to the Labour Party, and that's 50% of people I speak to where Labour's mentioned. So that's bad for them. The other part of it is I don't think politicians care. Politicians want a low turnout because it benefits them. So if the turnout is only 20% and we win, great, because that's only 20% of the electorate I have to chase. I have to curry favour with. So if you don't vote, then I love you because I can ignore you. I don't have to do anything for you. So the less people who turn out and to vote, the career politicians actually love that. We're doing what they want us to do.
I'm not sure I buy that.
In 1999,
it doesn't speak to the point I made about Tony Blair went on record saying how disappointed he was.
Tony Blair went on record many times, and I don't believe a word he said most of the time he went on record. Ed?
It's a bit weird. It's all kind of getting... I don't know. Can you hear me? Am I still in?
Unfortunately, yep. Yes, Ed.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, can I hear you.
Am I still in the chat?
Yes.
Oh, very, very nice. I was just going to say that there was the Leeds Central by-election in 1999, in which Hillary Benn was elected, and it had a turnout of 19.9%.
Wow.
So, you know, what legitimacy does he have, Hillary Benn, or well, he does now, but I mean, back then in 99, with a turnout of 19.9%. So that's what we're going for.
I think the turnout's going to be lower than normal. So the turnout of the last general election in this area was 48%, I believe. It's going to be lower at this by-election because the amount of people I speak to who are sick of all of us, who are saying to me, Nick, I don't want to talk to you, don't want to talk to anybody. I'm getting bombarded by leaflets. I'm getting bombarded with people knocking on my door. No one's cared about me all my life. And suddenly, you all care about me and my vote and my area. I don't believe any of you. No, shame on all your houses. So I think turnout is going to be less than the 48%.
Well, good. It's a plague on all your houses.
That's it.
I had a really interesting interview the other day with a guy called Young Bob.
Mm.
And he was a very intelligent young guy, 17 years old. I don't know if you heard of him. And he does a lot of speaking at Speaker's Corner.
He's got a great fringe.
I've had him on my channel.
Yeah, I'm going to publish it in a few weeks' time. But he was great. It was really good, really interesting interview. I really enjoyed it. And he's very, very clever, perceptive young guy. Particularly, he was 17. But he was a malaprop. The malapropisms were which is when you get the phrase wrong. You know, so the tip of the ice cube.
Yeah.
Whatever, right? They were abundant, and he was kind of aware of it as well. And when I pointed it out, he was like, "Yeah, I know, yeah, you know." It was very interesting in a way. Lipton,
what malapropism? Miss Malapro, I know that story. It's a book.
Yeah.
What
do you want me to say?
Talk about Sheridan.
Sheridan?
Yeah. He's the writer of the play that has Mrs. Malaprop in it, isn't he?
The book. No, I have nothing to say about that. I just know that she's a book. With a character, Miss Malaprop.
Yeah, Mrs. Malaprop. Yeah, okay. All right,
Lipton, you've really invested in the chat format, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm more interested in Nick Buckley and policy. So, Nick, another issue. Why are you looking at me like that? This is a serious conversation. Financialization of the British economy is not the problem. In America, finance is funneled into entrepreneurship. In the UK, managers are responsible for deploying global finance. They're managing the finances of wealthy people. And as we said earlier, the UK is less entrepreneurial. But I'm wondering, is the UK less entrepreneurial because of a lack of regulations that make it easy for pension funds to invest in businesses? There have been talks about the mansion reforms. I don't know what they have achieved so far. But if we want to grow the economy, we have to incentivize financial managers to deploy their resources to the right people. If entrepreneurs are aware that they're going to get financing, then they're going to become more entrepreneurial. They will take more risk.
Mm. When it comes to finances and the economy, that's not my strong topic at all. So I've got no idea on most of the things you mentioned. Then I haven't got an opinion. I really don't know. I'll just go back to what I said before. For me, it's about removing government out of the way. If we can remove the government out of the way, people will make decisions themselves. People will try new things. People will try to succeed. But when you're being stopped all the time or you're having barriers put in your way, that just seems to stop many of the people I know.
We need to stop.
Fair question, because as I said before earlier, you're not a minister or anybody like that yet, but I'm just sharing these ideas with you.
Of course.
You will have the latitude as a member of parliament to pass relevant laws.
Absolutely.
Let's stop encouraging people to pointlessly go to university. I think that's one of the harms. It's created an elite, it's created too many elites. It's destabilized everything. So that should be the first problem. And then also I think that as you said, the DEI, and in particular the overpromotion of women, is a real problem, because they tend to put basically things like equality and harm avoidance above everything else, which is to the detriment of balance.
Could I just push back slightly? I disagree with the idea that there's an overproduction of elites. There's an overproduction of midwittery, because the universities have stopped being elite. That's the problem. It wouldn't even matter if they were doing irrelevant degrees, if they were doing them to a high level, because then you'd have genuinely critical people who were well-rounded, who could adapt themselves for all sorts. The problem is you've got people reliant upon being spoon-fed, which makes them incredibly pliant for what Nick's talking about, the society that does everything for you.
Well, I think when this guy Turkin talked about the overproduction of elites, what he meant was those that see themselves as potentially elite because they have a degree or whatever. And that's the problem we've caused. Obviously, there's only so many elite places as a barrister or a doctor. A doctor's a different case, but a barrister.
But then it's still slightly different, Ed, because there could be a very few elite-level jobs, but there could be a large elite population. In other words, people capable of elite performance competing for those jobs.
That's true, but then to be fair, though, I think if that were the case, then presumably we would just make perhaps that was the case 100 years ago. You'd just make the qualification border to get into the elite position higher.
Yeah, but I'm just pointing out what you have now is very few genuine elite jobs, but a huge midwit population who aren't elite in terms of attainment levels, basic literacy, basic numeracy, all these things that would be a bare minimum. There's university students now leaving worse educated than high school students in the 50s and 60s.
Yes, I agree with you. And this is, I see the nuance there with regard to Serkin's phrase overproduction of elites. Can I just finish my point? We're not overproducing the DEI is not count here, Lipton. Okay, I have the right to finish my point. Yes, Lipton.
No, I just wanted to say that I think that I should work for Nick Buckley when he wins. He's going to need a really good researcher and communicator like myself who understands policy.
That's right.
On Friday morning, if the news is good, please get my details off Ed and let's have a conversation.
Of course, yes. Like, I was going to run for a third party in Wales, but I have not been in the UK long enough. The only immigrant that's needed in the UK is that those should go home.
No.
Yes, that is my general policy. They should all go home except the ones that I know personally and like.
Yes.
And Lipton, I see that.
If Nick wins on Friday morning, I will give you £1,000.
I believe you. He gave me £20.
You give a joke on screen and then you'll keep it. You already owe him 20. But this is a thing that happened in Liverpool a year or so ago. Nick Hertz, recondite reference. Lipton is Ed's left foot. I don't know about that. If Nick wins on Thursday, there will be much rejoicing. Or even if Nick retains his deposit, there will be much rejoicing. Are you thinking you might retain your deposit?
I think I'm coming fourth and above. I'm going to beat the Lib Dems, I'll beat the Tories, I'll beat all the other candidates. I'm aiming for a top three finish. That really would be good. We will see. It's hard to know how well I'm doing, because I only speak... The people who are nice to me are voting for me, and all the other people I've not spoken to, so it's hard to know. But I am a local guy.
Any, Do you have any sense when they, what stage of the night they may be ready to announce?
People who know this better than me are saying they're probably about 3 o'clock in the morning. There's only one. It's only one election where normally they're counting, you know, 3-4 different seats at the same time. It's only one seat, so they reckon about 3 o'clock in the morning, unless it's very close and people demand recounts. So.
That's another thing that is a problem with Britain, is that it takes so long to get election results. In Finland, the polls close, and you have an approximate idea of the results within an hour.
Mm. But you've got six people and a reindeer voting.
Well, unfortunately, political correctness and DEI has meant that the reindeers now have a significant voting block.
Oh, by the way, Ed, on a complete tangent, I've now got quite a bad addiction to Salmiakki.
Oh, God, horrible stuff.
Oh, you mean you like it.
The drink or the food?
Oh, the food. The hardcore licorice.
Yeah. No, I don't mind it. I must say, I don't mind Salmiakki. I was repulsed by it at first. But what I do like more than Salmiakki is Salmiakki-flavoured things.
All right. So, I haven't tried it. I've just tried the licorice.
No, but Salmiakki chocolate.
Oh, Nick, have you heard of Salmiakki, yeah?
No, not at all.
It's just hardcore licorice, but they add ammonium chloride to make it triply salty.
Right. And I do like licorice.
Well, yeah, and the Finns, correct me if I'm wrong, Ed, the Finns basically, they make ammonium chloride in chemistry lessons and stuff, and they get a taste for it very early on.
They do. They give it to their babies. When they put their babies outside in the pram at -30 to sleep, which they do, then they give them Salmiakki.
It's bad if you've got hypertension.
No, I didn't know that. Have you had the alcoholic drink?
No.
So Salmiakki alcoholic drink, and when you drink it, it's so strong that there's pain behind your eyes. That's the only way I can describe it. It's the most extraordinary drink, because every Eastern European country seems to have their own little drink. So Latvia has Balzams, and there's various other ones. They always have their own alcoholic drinks, a strong liquor. And this thing, Salmiakki, it's painful. But yeah, there's a whole. If you go to a supermarket in Finland, then maybe a quarter of the massive sweet section in a supermarket will be given over to different kinds of Salmiakki.
Are you aware of any studies? Because someone's saying in the comments, I'm aware that it affects the way your kidneys. I've forgotten the name of the substance. There's a substance that's produced, and it affects your kidney function, and you lose potassium and you retain sodium, but it doesn't strike me that there's a huge influence on Finnish mortality rates.
No, I don't think so. No, I'm not aware of any studies on that. I will look into it.
But no, it has quite serious physiological effects if you overdo it. But I'm just curious, is it the Finnish people develop a tolerance, or is that rubbish? Is it just because the effects are exaggerated, or does it actually have a mortality effect on Finnish people?
I honestly can't say. So I will look in. That will be my homework.
But if I spend the next 10, 15 minutes asking you in different ways, would you be able to tell me?
That'd be really boring for the viewers. Just accept that I don't know the answer, and I will look into it over the coming week.
Thank you, Ed. I much appreciate that. But you never do your homework. Whenever I give you homework, you never do it.
But then there's other things come up and I forget and I can't.
It's the promises that hurt the most. I don't mind that you don't do it. It's the promise. You lie. You look me in the face and you lie.
All right, send me an email tomorrow reminding me to do the homework, and I will do the homework, because you should always do your homework on the boys, if you're watching.
Nick, that's why Ed would have made a great politician. He looks you straight in the face and he lies to you.
Always do your homework on the night that it's set. You should come in from school. Don't just come in from school and put in some microchips and watch Countdown or 15 to 1. No, that's not the way you get in. Let's say you get in from skating to school about 4 o'clock, right? It's like there's Countdown, 15 to 1, Ray Steady Cook. I'm thinking mid-90s here when I was at school. You know, and what I do is I do those first. I'd have a microchips and then I'd watch 15 to 1, Radio City Cook or Countdown. I forget what.
There was 15-1 Comper guy was weird. He'd had like a charismarectomy.
William G. Stewart, yeah, he was weird, wasn't he? Like,
I think he owned the production company. That's why he could. That's why he could compare it.
John, question or nominate? Nominate Pete.
No, yeah, seriously, yeah. Eddie made you look really charismatic.
Well, I have been told I am slightly charismatic, so. But he was. I mean, Bob Holness, I miss him, but that was a bit earlier in the day.
Do you know I failed an audition for Blockbusters?
Did you?
Yeah, our school, there's five of us, and we're in a hotel room being interviewed, and they had these tiny little buzzers that I never looked at because they weren't the real buzzers. And it said, which H said, I'm in control when Ronald Reagan got shot? And I shouted, his wife.
No, it was the...
That was wrong, believe it or not.
It was the Secretary of State.
It was Haig.
Yeah. And he was wrong, though, because there was a deputy president, there was a vice president. So, with George Bush. So, it was actually George Bush that was in control. So he got confused. But, yeah, they'd have known that question in 1986 or when it was you were at school, presumably.
Yeah, school. I was 17.
Yeah. What I always thought was weird about that was that there was one team of two people and one team of one person.
Yeah, but it was shorter. One route was shorter than the other.
Yeah, but it's rather unfair, surely.
You didn't have to get as many questions right if you're on your own. Plus the fact two people can, not in a negative way, they can interfere, they can, trip each other up, expecting the other person to answer.
And which one were you applying for, one or the two?
No, I mean, our school, two people went forward and they didn't do very well, so that cheered me up.
I was on, in 1991, I was on a thing called Connect 4.
Oh, I remember that.
On the children's channel on cable telly. and I didn't do very well. I didn't get my questions right. The question was a series of things like England, Britain, something else, Ordnance Survey. And what the answer was map, but I didn't know that. I didn't know what
Ed, what a Finnish game show's like.
Well, Finns don't do original things, so what they are is foreign game shows. There's someone in Wai-Uli, which is like their BBC, that sits there and says, let's watch foreign stuff and make a Finnish version of it. So there's a Finnish version of anything you can think of, like Amazing Race, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, but they're so tight that you get like 250,000 euros, nothing close to being
The Russian version of that was hilarious. The Russian, you ask the audience, they had to stop doing it because the audience in Russia kept deliberately giving the wrong answers because their attitude was, why would I want someone else to get a million rubles?
Also, a million rubles doesn't sound that much.
Well, anyway, the equivalent, you know what I mean? But I thought that was very funny. I warmed to the Russian people when I heard that.
No, I like that. But yeah, they don't really do their own things. It's not it's this weird thing. It's hard for us to get used to in Britain. Like, go back to the 80s when we didn't make many TV programs and we imported a load of American bollocks like that. I remember that was the case. That was clearly, even commercials. We even had commercials in the 80s that were dubbed. Like, it's like that here. So they don't really do their own stuff.
You know, if someone phoned you on phone a friend, you'd give the wrong answer deliberately, wouldn't you?
If it was you, I would, Paul, yeah. Undoubtedly, it'd be some area that I knew about, like, race science. And this person applied RK theory to human races. J. Philippe Rushton, Richard Lynn, Lipton Matthews, or Bungle. It's Bungle. It's Bungle from Rainbow. Clearly, it's clearly Bungle from Rainbow that applied life history strategy to humans. And you go, Chris. You'd say, or Jeremy Clarkson these days. You go, it's Bungle.
Serious question.
£1 million.
Nick, when you win, are you going to introduce a bill to get rid of the Equalities Act?
Again, one MP wouldn't be able to do that. But the next government, depending who it is, maybe getting rid of the Equality Act. There's so many acts that need to go. Yeah. And what I've learned over this many few years is the Conservatives, the only thing the Conservatives have conserved have only ever been Labour policies.
Exactly. I was just about to say that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the only thing the Tories ever conserve is the previous Labour government's policies.
That's
many things need
obviously. Do, though, isn't it? Conservatives conserve what's already been done. They don't. Yeah. It's radical conservatives that basically what others would call fascists that actually go for it. What about the idea, Nick, of, and we did this in 1660, I believe, or 1661, I figure, like just an act of oblivion, where we say that all legislation that has been passed since the treasonous government of the 2nd of May, 1997, is null and void under this act. As in the same way that Trump said, I'm going to invade Greenland or whatever, when he backed down once he got what he really wanted, then what that would mean is that civil servants would be running to you saying, for God's sake, preserve this, for God's sake, preserve this, for God, and therefore under amendments and at the committee stage, the most important stuff that we can't possibly revoke, like, I don't know, Scottish devolution or whatever, would then remain. But then almost everything, like the anti-free speech laws, whatever, would be struck off. An act of oblivion.
I think something like that is probably needed. After we left the EU, we called it the bonfire of the regulations, and that never happened. But something needs to happen now. We need to pull out of many of the international treaties, like the UN's Convention of Refugees. We need to pull out the ECHR. We need to, you know, then look at domestic stuff, as you've said. We need to pull out Tony Blair's Human Rights Act out of our legislation. There's so many. And so one piece of legislation that does that, I'd be very happy looking at that.
And what about, like, when they passed the Act of Oblivion, then a lot of the people that have been responsible for the stuff that happened under the interregnum, they were hanged, drawn, and quartered.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but what I would do is I'd like to look at legislation that gives government ministers the ability to sack civil servants. Now, not every civil servant, but definitely the top 2, 3, 4, 5 layers of civil servants in their department. So if the civil servants aren't doing as they're told and not performing, the minister in charge can go, I'm sorry, Sir Humphrey, but you're gone. I'd like to see legislation that allows that.
I see your point, because, of course, a lot of the people that have been involved in these treasonous policies have been women. And historically, you don't hang, draw, and quarter women, you burn them.
Well, you know, don't you throw them in a pond, and if they sink, they're innocent?
No, that's witchcraft.
Because if Alistair Campbell was thrown in a pond and drowned, I'd admit that he was right all along.
Yeah, but if we did that, then that would mean that someone like David Lammy, if we threw him in a pond, he'd obviously sink. So,
well, fat actually floats, so we don't know with David Lammy.
That's a good point. Yeah, he's a ballast. They're ballast. Yeah. It would be thin people that would sink, like
Peter Mandelson.
Peter Mandelson, which is Sunak. they would be embraced by the waters and thus innocent of witchcraft, whereas people like Diane Abbott would be bobbing on the top.
But then she's guilty, and then you can hang them.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
There's no bad outcome.
There's no. They either drown.
Yeah.
No, I assume they dragged them up before they drowned.
No.
No. No. It was like in the Blackadder thing about this, in Blackadder the First, the unfunny Blackadder series. It was trial by axe. If the person is innocent, the axe bounces off their head, and we burn them. If the person is guilty, the axe bounces off their head, and we burn them. If the person is innocent, the axe simply slices their head off. Yes, trial by axe. It's a shame that. But yes, well, good. Ooh, Tommy. I don't know what's going on here. Where we are. But yeah, Peter Mandelson's the idea of apparently, I don't know if this is true, but when they arrested Andrew, he actually said, "You can't do this. I'm the son of the Queen." So the entitlement. I mean, there's a whole book about this guy by a guy called Andrew Lowney called Entitled. But the entitlement, I always thought the idea of the upper class was that, yes, they don't have to worry about money and stuff like that, but they get beaten senseless at school. And so they're rather like Spartans. And so it's all kind of balances out. And I found this when I was at university. I don't know if you did, Paul, because you went to a similarly posh university. That the people that were the problem were the private school kids. The public school kids, they had all of the wealth and stuff like this, and never had to worry about money. But, you know, they were beaten senseless and sexually abused at school. So they suffered. And I found them quite reasonable, the people that had been to Eton and whatever. But the people that had been to some, that were the day boys at some private school, they had all the wealth, all the lack of worry, everything, and they'd never suffered. And the people that had been to state school, of course, they had no wealth and whatever, and they'd suffered. So it was those people that had been to the private school, people like Richard Granham, that had never really suffered. They were the decadent ones.
This discussion is brought to you by the Suffering Corporation.
Yeah, yeah. Brought to you by the British Promotion, the British Society for the Promotion of Corporal Punishment and Flogging.
You're right, Lipton.
Yeah, I am good. I'm just thinking about serious issues, like intelligence.
Stay on what you say, Lipton, because we've got 8 minutes left, and I want to
keep
this up.
I'm just thinking about intelligence and public policy and schools and teachers and the decline in intelligence of college students. That's all.
This is true, Nick. This is the question that nobody wants to look at. Like, we're getting less intelligent because clever people don't have kids. Particularly clever women. Although it looks like it's reversing. It's interesting. It looks like it's reversing. But it's still there. And so what are we going to do about that?
I've seen some of your videos on this, so I'm a little bit abreast of this. Yeah, I mean, I think you said about 1970 was peak intelligence. That's when we basically got to the moon. It's been downhill ever since. Technology has got a lot to play because we think we're more intelligent than we really are because we live in a technological world, but we don't understand how our iPhone works, how the car works, how Wi-Fi works. But because we have access to that, we think we are more intelligent. And then you're looking at the reproduction of society. The more intelligent, the richer you are, they have less children. The more poor you are, less education you have, the more children they have. So the replacement is there. I'm not sure what happens in the future. I think human societies have been through this before. Cycles up and down, collapse of civilization, something else grows out of the dust. I think we'll just wait and see.
I don't like that. I mean, if you were my member of parliament, I'd like you to have a clear idea on what to do.
Yeah, but Ed, that's a misconception. Not there aren't always solutions. Often cultures go into terminal decline. You just have to see it out.
That's true.
And I think that the only answer really would be looking at eugenics and looking at who can breed and who can't breed. That's a slippery slope.
The clear answer is the abolition of higher education for women. Clearly.
Is that a vote winner on the doorstep, Nick?
No.
Unfortunately, women can vote. And that, again, is something we need to think about.
We should limit the franchise. We surely should. Women are empathetic. They support redistribution, and many of them are pro-mass immigration.
And then, but to be fair though, Lipton, if you go back to the generation born in the 20s, women were more right-wing than men.
Yes, I don't know.
Because they're socially conformed.
Exactly. Women are a product of their culture. So the culture is woke, therefore women are exceptionally woke.
So Lipton, is your idea, rather than win a rational argument, you ban the people most likely to disagree with you from voting?
Well, the people who are most likely to disagree with me don't want a rational argument.
But you're not giving women a chance. You're just saying they should be banned.
No, we have given them a chance. And they
how good they are at these things.
I almost forgot, you know, and this is for you as well, Nick. You know, in Gorton, you've got the Greens.
Yeah.
And I was really puzzled by this. Just think about it logically. If the Greens are recognising trans women, but there's also an Islamic element to the Green vote. What happens if a load of trans women went to the mosque? Because under Islam, any rational imam would recognize God doesn't make mistakes, and they're obviously blokes. So the imam would probably quite happily take them in. And then you've got a situation where the trans women would have to complain because they'd been allowed in and there were no other women there, because that's discriminatory.
Yeah, it's a lot more simpler than that. So trans women wouldn't turn up at a mosque because they may be mental, but they're not that mental, because they wouldn't believe in that mosque. And the Muslim vote for the Green Party isn't about the Green Party. This is a Trojan horse takeover of the Green Party by radical Islamists who want their own party.
But yeah, how's that going to work out? It's such a ridiculous mismatch of values and theology.
And that's why it's a Trojan horse attempt at the moment. Once they've got the numbers, once they've got enough people on the executive committee, you will see the woke, the trannies, you'll see all them being expelled. The people who care about the planet will all be expelled, and it will be the Green Party. Green is the colour of Islam.
But then how does that work? Because on a national level, I can see in certain sections, but at a national level, when the Green, like Brighton, wherever, they're not going to change their nature. So I'll just be fascinated to see how it all plays out.
I think it'll just implode. Before the next general election, the Green Party will implode. Just like Jeremy Corbyn's Your Party has already imploded. You can't have radical Islamists next to pink-haired woke fools. It's oil and water. There will be conflict.
You have the same bizarre collaborations on the right. So you have women who are TERFs. They're very, very feminist, and they're TERFs. And they're now on the right, and they're collaborating with like fundamentalist Catholics or whatever that think that women shouldn't get out to vote. It's not stable.
Yeah.
And it can't last. And you get these kinds of bizarre coalitions in various circumstances like this.
And I think it goes back to that phrase, which I hope I don't say wrong because you'll correct me again. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Until the battle's over, and then we become enemies again.
Yes, exactly. And so there was a History Debunked, I think it was saying today, well, look, for God's sake, people across the UK, Irish, whatever, we need to unite against the common enemy. And that's exactly what we'll do. We'll unite against the common enemy until the enemy is repelled, and then we'll get back to fighting each other.
Yeah,
these things are temporary. If there was no immigrants, no in the UK, then the issue would be, Ireland wants a, you know, Northern Ireland should be part of the Republic, and North-South divide. And all this stuff, but those things don't matter. Like when I was a kid, I remember someone saying to me when I was at university that he'd never met a Southerner before, never met one, and he thought of us as almost a different species. And suddenly he had a friend that was a Southerner. But these things don't matter when there's an external problem, you know. So it's like aliens. If aliens came, we'd repel the aliens. We'd unite as the one humanity. Repel the aliens. Of course, there'd be people on the left that would sympathise with the aliens and would fight for them. And then we'd carry on from there. So it's true. It's temporary. Right, I'm going to wrap up now. So what I want to say is, if you are, I don't know what percent of my audience are watching in the specific suburb of Manchester that Nick is standing in, but there must be some. So because there's loads of you. Gorton and Denton fellows. So what's your final pitch, Nick?
My final pitch is, don't be told who to vote for. Check out all the candidates. Look at what they've done historically. Look at how they can help your area. Don't be bullied and don't be scared into voting for national parties because this is a national issue. Be a little bit selfish. Find the best candidate that you think is going to improve your life, your street, your neighbourhood. Be a bit selfish at this election, because this election will change nothing nationally. All it can do is make your area a little bit better with the right candidate.
And that right candidate is Nick Buckley, MBE. So go and vote for him. All right. Thank you, chaps. We will see you soon. Tally ho and goodbye.
Goodbye.